Welcome to the Borderless Podcast, your guide to traveling, investing, and living beyond borders, where we talk about living the life that you want to live, where you want to live it.
All right, everybody, thanks for joining me on another Borderless Podcast. This is James Guzman. Today is kind of an interesting interview I have today. This is Nick Giambruno, which many people know. He's with Casey Research, been Doug Casey's globetrotting companion all around the world, looking at different crisis investing areas. And we actually met in a way that was kind of interesting. I was throwing a barbecue because I was leaving Medellin, and a friend of mine invited him. And it wasn't until a little while that we got to talk until I realized that it was Nick Giambruno, who I'd read some of the stuff for years. So it was pretty funny. And anyways, I thought we had a great conversation today. And it just shows, you know, some of the great contacts you can make and some of these kind of new burgeoning hubs around the world for digital nomads, et cetera. And I had a good time in Medellin. I am now back in San Miguel de Allende. You know, it was kind of an interesting thing that happened to me on the way back. You know, I'll just make a confession. I was actually, you know, I overstayed my visa for 2 weeks. So how it works in Colombia is that you have a three-month visa, and then you can extend for another 3 months. I bought a plane ticket 2 weeks after the three-month extension, and I figured it would be easy enough to go ahead and extend it. Went on the website, thought the website was useless. I tried for, you know, I don't know how many hours. I was sitting there trying to upload my documents. It didn't work. And then I said, oh, well, I got to go to the office and I need an appointment. And I kept trying to do all this. A lot of people told me, you know, don't worry about it. You can just pay a fine when you leave. And it's no problem. Now, that seemed plausible to me because actually that is how it works in Mexico. If you overstay your six-month visa, normally you just have to pay a fine and you're on your way. So I did that. I figured 2 weeks after the three-month mark wasn't a whole lot. And when I went to leave, they actually were not happy about that. And they deported me and said that I cannot return for a year. So now I have on my passport has deported on there. So, you know, I wasn't sure if I was going to go back in the next year or not. I mean, I wasn't against the idea. I've made a lot of friends down there, but I guess now that's kind of solidified. I think that it probably has a lot to do with the Venezuelan influx that they're seeing right now in Colombia. I've noticed that throughout Latin America in general, there's been kind of a clampdown on immigration. Another thing is when I was entering Mexico, they asked for a flight leaving Mexico. I've never been asked for that before. In the 8 years that I've been coming to Mexico, I've never had to have a flight that is leaving Mexico to somewhere else when I come in. So, you know, these are things that are happening. I think that this is all part of kind of where we're going with technology and kind of the breakdown of the welfare state or the nation states. I mean, I do think that's kind of what we're seeing, and that we're going to have the rise of, you know, populism, regionalism. And, you know, that's what we're seeing. And so all I'm saying is, you know, don't be surprised if you see kind of the crackdown on different immigration things. I know that in the United States, you know, the media cycle, which dominates the world, it seems like it's all focus on U.S. immigration. But I think that this is happening all over the world. There's kind of a lot of people that are not happy with open immigration and globalization and stuff like that. And so we'll see where it goes. You know, I'm certainly not saying that this is a good way that we're going, but this is the way that things are going. And that's what, you know, I'm predicting that will probably happen. You know, another thing I would say is that, you know, since being back here in Mexico, I wanted to talk about Mexico for a second. We do talk about it in the interview with Nick. I think a lot of Americans, maybe they don't realize that, you know, there's a pretty big election coming up. I'm going to try to put this out soon, and at the end of the week is going to be the election here in Mexico. And it looks like we're going to have AMLO win. Well, we'll see how it goes, but this is what it looks like. And AMLO is a very populist candidate, very left-wing, I would say, kind of a Bernie Sanders type. And I do not think that this is going to be good at all. You know, there's a lot of problems in Mexico right now. And with this guy coming into power, you know, one of the things that has come out within the last week is that he's urged some of his supporters. He said at his rallies that you know, if they don't have a job, if they're not feeling good in Mexico, then they have a human right to enter the U.S. However they need to. So, you know, as you can see, I mean, that is going to create a lot of tension, probably, especially with the Trump administration. We're going to see trade wars, you know, cultural wars, I don't know what. But I'm not very optimistic and feeling very good about that whole situation. And so we'll see how it goes. We'll see how it goes. But I will say that in I did get a different feeling in, you know, in Colombia. They had an election that seemed to turn out well. A lot of the people there were very entrepreneurial, very much accepted foreigners down there to do business. They were, you know, open to, you know, helping them establish their business and stuff like that, no problem. So I would say that between the two, you know, I'm probably much more optimistic about the outlook of Colombia than I am of Mexico at the moment. But here I am, and so I'm still enjoying life here as it goes. And I'm really happy to give you this interview today. Nick is a real expert on, you know, flag theory and living internationally, investing internationally. And I think that we have a lot of knowledge in this interview. And so I'm glad to bring it to you. So thanks again for listening. And here it is. Borderless. All right, everybody. Thanks for joining me on another Borderless podcast. I am here with Nick on the line. Nick, thanks for joining me.
James, great to be with you.
Absolutely. Where are you coming from? You're from China right now, right?
Not quite. I'm en route to China. I'm actually in Tijuana at the moment because that's the easiest way to get, at least for me, from Medellin, where we just met a few days ago, yeah, to China. There's a direct flight, incidentally, from Tijuana.
Yeah. Okay, great. Yeah, so, you know, just this last weekend, you know, I had a barbecue at my house, and I got to meet Nick there, and it was just great. We had, you know, great conversations, and, you know, people there were saying, man, you know, we should really get some of this stuff on tape, because there was a lot of good conversation, right? So it's it's really incredible the type of people that you meet, you know, in these different types of hubs, you know. I've really enjoyed Medellin. It sounds like you've kind of been coming back there and kind of thinking about establishing yourself there as well, right?
Yes. Well, actually, I have been established in Medellin for about 3 years now. Mm-hmm. It's a wonderful place for some of the reasons you mentioned. And it's great. It's great to meet other like-minded expats there as well.
Absolutely. Yeah, I mean, this is something that's different about, you know, kind of being in these types of communities or hubs that are popping up in different areas where you get location-independent entrepreneurs and people that are thinking about internationalizing themselves. You know, one other great aspect is, you know, you can always go and network, you know, in the States somewhere at a regular meetup or something like that. But there's really something different about these areas where, you know, for people that actually, you know, take the risk and have the guts to go out and do things. I've noticed, you know, how many great people I've met just on a regular basis there. So even in the 3 months that I've been here in Medellin, I've made some really great contacts.
Yeah, that's great to hear. And no, I know the dynamic you're describing. It acts as sort of a filter, you know,
right.
You get the higher quality people just because they've, you know, necessarily they've had to had an open mind, and not only an open mind to come to a place that most people would be afraid of. I mean, you say Medellin to most Americans and they think of that stupid Netflix show,
right.
And they're like, oh, why would you ever want to go there? So immediately you get rid of all of those people, which is the vast majority of people, and you have people who not only are able have their minds open to it, but are also, you know, financially and physically and so forth able to do it as well.
Right. So I wonder, you know, I know why, you know, I've thought it's been very interesting here, and you know, I'm pretty positive on the country as a whole, Colombia. So what are some of the specific reasons that you've chosen to spend so much time here?
It actually came, it started out as a purely financial decision at first, because as you know, the real estate in Colombia trades in pesos, the local currency, the Colombian peso. And it's not like that in most of Latin America. Most of Latin America, it trades in dollars. So what that means is in Colombia, there's the potential for you to get some, if you're a dollar-based person, to get some bargains on the real estate. Because if the currency depreciates significantly, It so does the real estate if you're bringing dollars in. And at the time, about 3 years ago, when I was looking at the place as an investment location, the Colombian peso, I think, had gone from around 1,600 or something to past 3,000. So it really it lost nearly 50% of its value. And therefore, the real estate was about 50% cheaper because the real estate prices didn't jump up in tandem, not even close, to the exchange rate change. So that's what originally drew me to Medellin, but I ended up finding out that it's such a pleasant place to live that it turned into more than a financial and investment decision, but also a lifestyle decision as well, because it has beautiful weather year-round. It's very inexpensive. The quality of the food, fruits and vegetables, fish is just really, really high. And the people, the Colombian people are very kind, hardworking people. So yeah, for all those reasons, I decide to spend about 3 to 4 months of the year in Colombia.
Right. And, you know, most people, they choose to definitely not go over the like 6 month mark, right? Because then it become a tax resident and that can have some problems attached to it, or some complications, we should say.
Yeah, and I think that's true in a lot of countries, mm-hmm. Where if you spend more than 6 months of the year there, you're tagged a tax resident and subject to all sorts of nasty things. Right. So I think just as a general rule of thumb, it's always better to be treated as a tourist than a tax resident.
Right, right.
In most cases, I think most people can, I mean, sometimes you do need to be a resident, and sometimes there are advantages of being a resident in certain areas, but I think unless you have a clear idea of what those benefits are, just be a tourist.
Right. Yeah, everybody around the world likes tourists. You know, they just think, oh, they're coming, or they want to make sure that they have a good time, they're coming to spend money and all this. It's kind of different when people see you as a citizen or as a, you know, a taxable person there, right? You get treated completely differently. So
yeah, it is. I mean, yeah, you get treated as a source of income to be squeezed,
right,
rather than like a client to be courted or a tourist to be courted.
Right, right. Yeah, and I tell you, I thought this was very positive. What happened? What was this Sunday with the election here? I thought that turned out well. You know, some people were kind of worried about which way that would go, but I think that overall things look positive, and there's a lot of room for growth here, which, you know, I can't really say that about a lot of South American countries. I know that you also, you know, you spend time in Buenos Aires and some other ones. Are there other places that around, let's just say around the world, what other places are kind of your other home bases or have, you know, places that you enjoy spending time?
Sure. I'll just take a step back. And yes, you're absolutely right about Colombia. It does seem like the country is on the rise. So, you know, one, I think, specific metric you can look at that tells that story, if you could just boil it down to one, look at how fast the middle class in Colombia is growing. I believe over the past like 10, 12 years, it's nearly doubled, the Colombian middle class. So I don't know. Those probably aren't exact figures in the exact time frame, but it's definitely something in that range, in that ballpark range. And that's a healthy sign. A healthy middle class and a growing middle class is a healthy sign. And not just that, but the direction of where it's going, where you can see in the U.S., for example, okay, maybe it has a bigger middle class, but it's shrinking, and you can see it shrinking. So the trajectory is not good in the U.S., but it is good in Colombia. And you can, I don't know, you can't really describe it, but you can, I can feel it at least. I can feel and that's a very positive thing. But yeah, I guess it was a little worrisome with the election,
right?
The blatant socialist. I didn't think he had a chance to win. I mean, I know. I mean, they're right next to Venezuela. It's like, oh, can I have some of that hyperinflation and poverty, please? I'd like some more of that. You know, it's,
right? Yeah, you know, and how horrible of a situation it is over there. The only good thing I can see is that at least we have like an example to point at and say, hey, you know, this is what happens. Here's just yet another one that you can see in real time right next door, or, you know, whatever. You can use this an example of when these types of policies get implemented. So,
Yeah, I mean, it's almost as if you have a delinquent neighbor and you observe him, you know, sniffing paint and the problems it causes. Oh, I'd like to try some of that too, please. I mean,
yeah.
Well, that thankfully that's not what happened in Colombia, and I think there is a constituency for that in Colombia for sure. But I don't think it's at this point, it doesn't seem to be taking over the country or even close to it.
Right. So what are some other places that you enjoy spending time nowadays?
Yeah, I really like, as you mentioned, I really like South America, and in particular, Argentina's nice as well. They tend to have economic problems, which are well known, and have had crazy governments in the past too. But that being said, as a foreigner and as a tourist who doesn't as someone who doesn't operate a business there, it's generally a pleasant place to be,
mm-hmm.
Because you know that kind of stuff. You're separated from that stuff, and those are serious problems. But that aside, it's a very pleasant place to be. It really feels like a European country that's geographically located in South America.
We're talking about Buenos Aires here, right?
Yeah, Buenos Aires, yeah. But just South America as a whole, you kind of look around the world, and there are some serious problems on the horizon for North America, certainly with the U.S. And parts of Mexico. You look at Europe. Europe is on the cusp of some very serious problems, as well. Asia seems to be getting better, but you know who knows what will happen with North Korea and China. But South America is really just off the radar of a lot of these really big potential problems in the world, and that's you know one of the reasons I like it.
Yeah, well, that's great. Yeah, I mean, I actually you know agree with you there. You know, I've spent the last 7 years, spent a lot of time in Mexico, but kind of with you there. You know, I think that there's some problems there with the oil industry, and they have a very important election coming up here as well. So we'll have to see how that goes.
Yeah, and I think the point too is to be flexible. You want to, you know, of course, establish some bases in some places because you know
right.
just you know it's just for comfort, and you know you want to be in places you like, but you also want to get out of, you know, nothing stays the same forever and things can change. So you want to have that flexibility and an option to seek out other places if things go bad in one place too.
Right. Now, you write for the International Man. You do research for, you know, Casey Research. And, you know, there's this theory, the PT theory, flag theory, this type of thing that you guys have been writing about for a while. I've also mentioned it a lot, and but I don't think that I've covered it quite enough. Maybe if you don't mind, we can go over some of that. What exactly is the PT theory, flag theory? How can someone implement this kind of thing in their life?
Sure. I think simply what it does is the bottom line is that it minimizes your exposure to government coercion. And I think that's in other words, it makes you a more sovereign and free individual. And I think in terms of practicality, sure, you can maybe go live out in the middle of the woods and nobody is going to bother you. But if you want to, apply these kinds of concepts in real life and minimize any one single government's ability to coerce you or force you to do certain things, this is, in my opinion, the best way to achieve that from a practical standpoint in the world today. And as you mentioned, yeah, it's all about putting different aspects of your life or your business in different jurisdictions that make the most sense. In the same, think of it, you know, everybody knows the common investment advice. Oh, you don't want to put all your eggs in one basket. You want to have some stocks, some bonds, some real estate, some precious metals, and so forth, so that if one asset class does bad, you know, you're kind of diversified. It's the same kind of concept, but you apply it to different countries and different governments and different types of sovereign risk. And most people don't think about things that way. But if you do basically the same kind of diversification strategy along those lines, you can really live as a more free individual than I think you can in any other way. It's the in terms of practicality, that's how you achieve that status of being as free and as sovereign of an individual as you possibly can.
Right. Yeah, and so PT, you know, it basically stands for a lot of things, but one thing is permanent tourist, perpetual traveler, previous taxpayer, this type of thing.
Yeah.
But, you know, one of the ideas is that, you know, just like we spoke about before, that, you know, it's a good idea for a lot of the time if you're, you're considered to be a tourist because you're treated better. And so, you know, where you're spending a lot of time, another thing in the PT theory they call is like playgrounds or areas that you don't necessarily do any, or you shouldn't be like doing business, but you're just spending time there, passing through, and that way, you know, people just, you know, enjoy having you there, and there's no kind of tension as far as that goes, and so you can spend a lot of time in a place that you just, you know, has a you know, a low cost of living that you enjoy, and you know, obviously, if something happens that it's no longer favorable, then you can start thinking about going somewhere else. And then, you know, you can also have a corporation in another jurisdiction that has good corporate laws. And, you know, of course, this has to do with, you know, tax structures as well and that kind of thing. And your investments and others. So another part of this is just your investments, where you want to have your investments. You guys write about frontier markets, you know, diversifying in that aspect, kind of finding different asset classes and things like that. I think that not only, well, also what they've added to that, I've seen some of the flag theory is they talk about where your servers are or where your online identity is as far as intellectual property and things like that. But I think that another jurisdiction that we can add to the investment class, which I've talked about on this podcast before, is just the internet in general. I think that, you know, so if you buy, you know, you can buy real estate in Colombia, for instance, you can buy, you know, a store in, you know, run a store in Puerto Rico or something, or you could have a store online in e-commerce, you know, kind of in the cyberspace. And so I think that's kind of another frontier that is interesting. A lot of people are, you know, obviously moving into that area, theoretically, you know, they're a lot of more people are coming online, spending more money online, and so that's also a good place to kind of plant a flag. So,
yes, I definitely want to come back to that because I think your digital presence is, you know, this flag theory mm-hmm. has been around for decades. It's been around longer than the internet's been around. So I definitely think the digital presence is a very important new flag. But one thing I wanted to mention real quick, as a matter of practicality, as somebody who's lived as a you know, basically a perpetual traveler and permanent tourist, is that you're going to come across these bureaucrats and all sorts of other people that are going to want to like place you and put you in a box. So what you don't want to do, you want to have a place that you can call yourself as a resident. Because if you say, oh no, I'm just kind of this guy who's a drifter, who's, you know, just bound, you know, they're going to think you're like some sort of economic migrant or something like that. And it's not going to be good. So I've never heard, I've heard plenty of horror stories where people who are honestly like digital nomads and you know, whenever you go into a country, you see the card, like, oh, what country are you a resident of? You know, they're just trying to put you in a box. Don't try to like, you know, be smart with these buffoons at the customs. Just say whatever your passport says, and then, you know, fine, there you go. So I'm a U.S. citizen. I always just say U.S., even though I'm really not a resident of the U.S. But as far as Mexico is concerned, when I'm visiting their country for a few weeks, yes, I'm a U.S. resident.
Right.
I'm just not going to say, like, oh, I kind of, you know, bounce around from place to place and I'm not really a resident. That's just going to invite scrutiny. So
sure.
Just a practical tip for people on that. And then going back to the digital presence, it is hugely important, as we've seen with all these scandals with Facebook and Google and Apple and Snowden, and, you know, the list goes on. But I mean, your digital presence, just think of how important that is and how much information it contains about you. I mean, it's almost, you know, it contains so much information, but your financial life, you know, where you physically are, just all that data in a cell phone, what that can tell about a person, the contacts and so forth. So having your digital presence diversified and properly secured is a hugely important component of this.
Mm-hmm.
And, it's a big component. This is not a small thing either. It's a very large thing, depending on if you operate an online business or you have a website or whatever. But what everybody has is an email address. And I would highly recommend looking at non-American email providers that use strong encryption. A personal favorite of mine is ProtonMail, which is based out of Switzerland, which has, is a very favorable jurisdiction for digital privacy and digital rights. Their servers are based out of Switzerland, and they're also operate out of Switzerland. So they're completely a Swiss company, and they have a free email. They have free email to a limit, but I mean, honestly, you just pay $40 a year and you have a very secure email, that uses unbreakable encryption, on your inbox and on your contacts. I find that one to be very handy, but that's just one example. Using VPNs is another example. A virtual private network is another example too, because you can physically choose where it looks like you want to appear to be connecting to the internet from, and that's, you know, diversification too. So those are two very important things. Obviously, you can get into servers and other aspects depending on if you operate a website as a business, but this is definitely an important part of flag theory, I think.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, that's a very complicated topic, I suppose. It's kind of just interesting to see how that, you know, theory that we were talking about has changed, because when the book was written, the original book, that was a while ago, and it's a really a lot of these people they were concentrating a lot on kind of privacy, and there were some things that you could do that weren't too big of tasks to do, but now it's kind of tough, but. Yeah, you can do it. I mean, other than those things you mentioned, is there, if somebody wants to get into how they can do that, is there anything that you would recommend them read up on or specific sites or something? How would they get more into that topic?
They can always check out the internationalman.com. There's a wealth of resources there on all aspects. And all the other kinds of topics that we've been talking about. So I would recommend people check that out.
Okay. Yeah, and you know, I think that one of the main reasons that a lot of people are looking to internationalize, and all this type of stuff over the last couple decades has been the amount of debt, right? In the West in general, in the U.S. And I mean, you've written about the super bubble in Europe. This has been going on for a long time, a lot longer than a lot of us had thought. What do you think's going on here? How do you see this? You know, I want to kind of dig into just this debt crisis. What are some scenarios that you see in the future? It doesn't seem like there's any good way to get out of this. I mean, I don't think growing the economy to be able to pay for trillions of dollars in debt is going to work. So. I'm sure that, you spent a lot of time thinking about this and all that. How do you, what are some scenarios that you see in the future? I guess we could just start with, let's start with Europe, since you've written about that, the super bubble in Europe. I mean, what's going to happen with this? How should we prepare?
Yeah. And it's very, how you prepare is similar, whether you're a European, an Asian, a Latino, or an American, it's a similar problem in the sense that debt, it just represents an obligation that the government has to make. And whether it's like a bond or a Social Security or a pension obligation, it's just an obligation. And what they're at its most basic level. And what it means is if they take on more obligations than they can afford, they're going to look for increasing ways to squeeze that wealth out of their citizens. And whether it's taxation, whether it's through money printing, or whether it's through outright confiscations, as we've seen in the past. So the bottom line is this, and this charade go on for a long time, is when we see governments go crazy with debt, They're going to extract it out of their populace one way or another, and it's not going to be pleasant. The big question, of course, is when it's going to happen and how is it going to happen. Though I would say it doesn't really matter how it's going to happen, because the bottom line is the same: is they're going to steal wealth from you. That's the bottom line. To pay for those obligations, they will steal wealth from you, whether it's through taxation, inflation, or confiscation, or a combination of those things.
Right.
That's what's going to happen. And so, what do you do in that situation? First, I would put your savings into something that can't be easily taxed, confiscated, inflated, or etc. That would be precious metals, cryptocurrency, or assets that are physically and geographically out of the reach of the government in question. So if you're an Italian and Italy is in the process of a debt crisis, which will probably come to a head in the months ahead, what do you do? The last thing you want to do is leave your money in an Italian bank in Italy, which is that's going to be the low hanging fruit for these people when the crisis really hits and they have to do something. They'll probably close the banks. Banks will fail. They'll probably do a bail-in. Actually, we know they'll do a bail-in. They've codified the bail-in legislation into law in Europe, Canada, and the United States. So we know what they're going to do. And we saw that happen in Cyprus. That was about 5 years ago. Can't believe it's been 5 years. But that was the trial balloon. It was a trial balloon in Cyprus. There was really no significant resistance to that. And that was a horrible thing, where the government basically just confiscated a lot of money in people's bank accounts, despite the fact that there was supposedly this deposit guarantee in the EU, which that goes out the window immediately in a crisis. I mean, you're going to depend on these people's promise that they're going to give you some sort of deposit guarantee. It's ridiculous. Mm-hmm. So that's the problem, and the solution set that I mentioned is that just get your assets and your savings into something that is more resilient and out of their reach is what you should do. I'm not saying go 100% all in on this, but you definitely want to have some diversification. It's a little insurance policy in case the worst happens. And with this debt, it looks like it is going to happen, and we just don't know when it's going to happen exactly.
Right. I mean, when I look at the whole situation, a lot of people in the United States are I guess optimistic. They're very happy about the economy. They think Trump is really opening up business, and that we're seeing a lot of growth here. I want good things to happen. But how can you look at the unsustainability of, all these obligations that the government has told the populace that they're going to give them? And I mean, one thing is just the student debt thing. I mean, it's ridiculous. If you want to look at all these different markets that I'm sure that they'll say is a black swan in the future when, people have been talking about this for years. But one big problem is, with student debt. I mean, it's just, you have all these young people that can't get what they would consider to be a decent paying job from what has been a decent paying job for, earlier, and then also for their parents. And, it's just not as many of those out there as what they expect. And so people have been continuing to go to university, and in hope that, with that degree, that they're going to get some job when they get out. And then if they don't find it within 6 months, they have to go back and get more of a degree so that they don't have to start paying back their student loans. And you just have so much misplaced labor, all these people that should be working, should be earning a skill, learning a skill and earning money or doing something. I mean, they're just, from what I see, a lot of people are completely wasting their time. And not only that, but, they're getting into debt. I don't see any way that this is going to be paid back. This no way possible. I mean, and what are we talking about? Way over $1 trillion now. Do you know the exact number? I'm not sure. I can't remember what it was.
Well, you're right. I think it's north of $1 trillion. But the bottom line is yeah, it doesn't matter. I mean, it's not able to be paid back is the bottom line.
So, and you know, like I said, and if that's not bad enough, it's just that, you know, you have all these people that, I mean, I think that, you know, young people, they actually think that they're doing something productive by spending their time in these universities. And they're learning a lot of times, you know, counterproductive things. And they're completely wasting their time. And so, you know, I don't know if there's going to be like some dramatic moment where all of a sudden, it just somehow crashes. I'm not sure if it's going to be a gradual thing where people say, you know what, you don't need to have a degree to work here. And, you know, all of a sudden the university's bottom line, you know, the new entrants start going down, which they already have for the last few years. And at some point, it just comes to a, you know, point where they're when they can't keep it up. But I mean, I think that we're with such a, as far as the you know, university debt bubble, where it's just at such a point now that there's going to have to be a dramatic shift. I don't know how it could be just a gradual, you know, back to some sort of reality in this area.
Yeah. Well. Well, yeah, I think you're right, and I think it's it's a vast problem. But I think, you know, well, let's just take a step back. You know, you're talking about, oh, people think the economy is improving and, right. and so forth. But these numbers are all fake. Mm. I mean, one of the things I've learned about living in Latin America is that nobody believes the government statistics in Argentina, for example. Nobody believes when the government says, oh, inflation's only 10% when they know it's like 40%. Right. Nobody believes this crap. And they don't believe the government. Nobody believes government statistics in Argentina, for example, and a lot of other places, and rightfully so. But the difference in the U.S. is that people actually believe this stuff still, and it's blatantly misleading and false. So you can look at the unemployment statistics. So yeah, you have all these millions of people who have given up looking for a job because they can't find a decent job and they just give up. Mm-hmm. Well, guess what? We're not going to count these people anymore. What? How can you not count these people? I mean, so this is just one aspect of how these numbers are fudged. And of course, the inflation number is fudged. They say, oh, there's only 2% inflation. 2% inflation? Has your health insurance gone up by only 2%? Has your grocery bill gone up by 2%? I mean, these people are... they're scamming everybody with these statistics, and the sooner that the average person wakes up to it, the better. That's the difference is that unfortunately Americans are a little more brainwashed. I mean, not just a little more; they're way more brainwashed than a lot of other people, and that they actually believe this garbage. So no, I don't think the economy is doing well when you look at it at the real numbers. Mm-hmm. So yeah, and then going back to the university issue, you're absolutely right. A lot of this stuff, whether it's debt, inflation, money printing, I view this as the root cause of this as the abandonment of sound money, because it just permeates in so many different areas. I mean, do you really think that people, if we had sound money, do you really think people would, you would need to have like savings, which would need to be not created out of thin air, but actually representing somebody's production, we would not have a student loan bubble because it would be necessarily harder for there to be credit. And credit would have to be based on savings, not based out of creating it out of thin air. So, gee, why are we surprised that when we no longer have to have base credit and savings on something real, that it can just be something that a central bank creates out of thin air and the banking system creates out of thin air? Why are we surprised when we see all these debt bubbles and debt rising and student loans? This is a complete consequence of having unsound money. But it's even worse than that because it perverts the culture.
Right.
So you have all of these people who don't really learn how to save because they don't have a sound vehicle to save in. And then they get into all this debt. It's not like these people are getting into debt to become doctors, engineers, and physicists, for example. Mm-hmm. Most of these people are getting degrees in gender studies and fill-in-the-blank studies and
but even if
economics,
I just want to interrupt you. Even if it is business, it doesn't really matter because you know a lot of the stuff that you learn in business school is garbage. And
sure,
I mean, really, if you want to be in business, the best thing you could do is be in business, get some experience in business. Honestly, look, I have a business degree, so I've never ever had anybody ask me for my business degree.
Yeah, and I have a finance degree, and honestly, I kind of work in finance and analyzing stuff and writing investment research. But honestly, the stuff that I learned, I didn't learn. I mean, and that's a relatively harder, but more useful degree than say some of these liberal arts degrees. Mm. But no, what I meant was is that instead these people aren't getting degrees in like hard skills like science, medicine, and so forth. They're getting these degrees. Not only are they taking on an enormous debt burden, but their heads are getting filled with garbage in a lot of instances, and they're not getting any sort of skill set that will allow them to service this possible debt that they've taken on. And it's led to hopelessness. And this is why you see politicians like Bernie Sanders and so forth rising among millennials. And millennials, I believe, according to recent polls, a majority of them are outright socialists.
Nice.
And that's, that's unfortunate, but it's also not surprising given the circumstances that a lot of millennials find themselves in. And this is where it leads to politics, because now you'll see support for, one of Bernie Sanders' policies is that debt forgiveness. We're going to forgive all the student loans. Mm-hmm. We're just going to, rip it up and get rid of it. But, of course, he has all sorts of other policies, too. So this is how you see this is exactly how you see a culture and a society get perverted by unsound money and bad economics.
Right. Yeah. And, I can't think of any time in history where, a country has started out kind of a republic, and then it's kind of expanded a bit, and then it expanded into an empire, and then it got really, really heavily indebted, and then everything just turned out great and kept going just fine. I don't think that's happened, so.
Yeah, I don't think so.
Now, another thing that you write about is, getting a second passport. You're talking about, we were talking about flag theory. One of the things that we didn't really mention was the passport aspect of it and citizenship. I mean, when we're looking at these different crises and stuff like that, I mean, it's helpful sometimes if you have the ability to travel with several different passports and things like that. So for people that maybe they're not too familiar with the second passport aspect, I mean, I did make a video, and I will probably link that in the show notes, which is just a quick rundown of how to get a second passport. But why would somebody want a second passport? And if they want one, how should they go about getting started to see how they can do that?
Sure. First, I'd say I'm not too thrilled about the fact that we need these little booklets with stamps on it. It's basically shows that you're owned by a certain government or you need special permission. Like 100 years ago, nobody had passports and everybody there was not really, the world got along pretty much fine. So I'm not celebrating the fact that we need passports. In fact, I don't really like them. But as a matter of practicality, it's you need them in today's world. Just that's the way it is. I don't necessarily like it, but that's the way it is. And if you're going to have passports, you might as well have as many of these things as you can to an extent so as to dilute the power and control that any one government exercises over you. So if you only have one passport, you really are at the mercy of that government. For example, the U.S. passport, if you're accused, not adjudicated or convicted or even charged, but if you're accused of a felony in the U.S., you can lose your passport. And there's an interesting study done by a civil liberties lawyer that the average, because there are so many laws on the books in the U.S., that the average person inadvertently commits 3 felonies a day. So they can really pin anything on anybody and then be like, oh, guess what? You committed a felony, so you're going to lose your passport. It's not as hard to commit a felony as most people think. as I just mentioned, you know, the average person commits three of them a day unknowingly. So commit a felony, you lose your passport. If you have tax problems, you can lose your passport too. This is just the U.S. And, you know, if you get into any sort of political problems with your government, say you're a dissident or you have problems with, you know, you're a dissident in some country where there are, you know, protests and so forth, if you're politically active, yeah, they can, any country can revoke anybody's passport at the drop of a hat for any reason they want to. And that's the bottom line, is the passport doesn't belong to you. It's not your property. It belongs to the government, and it's their property, and they use that as a weapon against you, and they use it as a weapon against individuals. So you might as well dilute this power they have over you by having as many of them as possible. With the caveat, I would make a caveat, that you don't want to increase your problems. So if you're a Canadian, it doesn't really make sense for you to get an American passport, because an American passport, or a United States citizenship, rather, entails you to a lifetime of taxes of on your worldwide income. That's not something you want to do. So you want to kind of look at what the pros and cons are. Most countries, it's probably fine to get another passport in, but you don't want to like sign up for a lifetime of taxation or potential military service, because some countries, if you become a citizen, they will draft you into the military, and they do expect that you serve in the military. So, you know, barring these caveats, it is generally a good idea to have more than one passport.
Right. And you have more than one. I know you at least have the Italian as well, right?
Yes, that's right. So getting another passport is not an easy thing. I mean, it's just, there is no way to do it that is at the same time legitimate, cheap, fast, and easy. It just doesn't really exist. If you have money, there are countries that have legal programs for you, like investor programs. You invest in the country, and they give you citizenship. Well, you really need, you know, you're going to be dropping at least $100,000 on those options. So at least, you know, these go up to in the millions of dollars, too. So this is not for everybody. You know, also, if you have heritage in certain countries, you can apply for citizenship based on your heritage, whether it's Italian heritage, Irish heritage, Polish heritage, and Spanish heritage, and so forth. So there's a number of countries that offer this, but that doesn't happen overnight. That will probably take a couple of years of paperwork and back and forth and patience before you get it, but you can get it. And then the old-fashioned way is to just become naturalized after being a permanent resident in a country for a certain amount of period. And of course, every country has different requirements for that. So, and these requirements are constantly changing. So those are kind of your menu of options here.
Okay. Yeah. Great. Thanks for that. You know, I do want to ask you about something. I'm sure a lot of people are wondering, what is it like, you know, working with Doug Casey and getting to know him? How has that been?
Oh, Doug is a great guy, and he's very humble and down to earth and approachable. So it's been you know, I don't really think of Doug as a boss or anything like that. I really think of him as like a friend and a partner in the business. And so it's actually wonderful to work with Doug. If you get to know him, he has a good sense of humor, and he's a real fun guy to hang out with, have a cigar with, have a drink with, and, you know, go to some messed up country with. So no, I very much enjoy working with Doug.
Yeah, I remember you saying that you were in Beirut, right? What was that about?
Yes, I actually met Doug in Lebanon, in Beirut, Lebanon. I used to live and work in Beirut, Lebanon, which is in the Middle East, on the eastern shore of the Mediterranean, next to Syria and Israel. And Doug, I've been reading Doug much longer than I've been working with Doug. Put it out in his newsletter that he was traveling to Beirut, and if anybody wanted to get together for a cup of coffee, to shoot him an email. And, you know, this was in his mass daily email. So I just replied. I didn't know that he would respond and actually want to meet up. But that's how I met Doug. And, you know, one thing led to another. And I've been working with him for about almost 6 years now.
Yeah. Isn't that interesting? And, you know, just in general, I find that, you know, a lot of people, you know, especially as they you know, go along in life and they get retired or things like this, you know, they're a lot more approachable than you think. And the funny thing is, is that there's a lot of people that have been very successful who, you know, you can establish a relationship with, you can ask questions. They're happy to answer your questions. They want to answer your questions. They want to pass down knowledge. Maybe they're, you know, they have some time on their hands they didn't have in the past and this type of stuff. So, you know, for people out there, if you're looking for, you know, a mentor or someone to help you with certain aspects or something like that of your business or your life, you really can. It's a lot, you know, easier than you think a lot of times just to reach out to people that you think maybe are, you know, way too, you know, out of your, you know, world to even speak to you. But I bet if you reach out that they'd be happy to talk to you.
Yes, I completely agree.
Yeah. All right. Well, great. So, Nick, let's talk about what you have coming up. Is there anything else? Well, I know that you have this big conference coming up. Is there anything else that you'd like to let us know about?
Yeah, well, that'll be an talking about a meeting with Doug Casey. If people are interested, we're having a conference in Bermuda later this fall in mid-October. And it'll be a chance, you know, to meet up with Doug, Bill Bonner, myself, and a handful of other people. And if people are interested in that, again, that's in Bermuda. I think that's from October 17th through the 19th. Don't quote me exactly on those dates, but it's definitely in that range. You can check out caseyresearch.com. There's all the details there.
Okay, great. Yeah, and if people want to check out your work, then they just go to caseyresearch.com, right? Or is there anywhere else?
Yes. Okay. Yes, that's right.
All right, Nick. Well, thanks so much. Let's definitely keep in touch, and thanks for the time today.
Sounds great. Absolutely, James.
Thanks for joining us for the Borderless Podcast, traveling, investing, and living beyond borders.